Okay, please turn in your Bible then to 1 Kings chapter 5. We're going to read the entire chapter. We're going to have just a quick review and then go on to the end of the second point tonight of the outline. 1 Kings chapter 5, reading from God's holy word. Now Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants to Solomon, because he heard that they had anointed him king in place of his father, for Hiram had always loved David. And then Solomon sent to Hiram, saying, "You know how my father David could not build a house for the name of the Lord his God, because of the wars which were fought against him on every side, until the Lord put his foes under the soles of his feet. But now the Lord my God has given me rest on every side. There is neither adversary nor evil occurrence. And behold, I propose to build a house. For the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord spoke to my father David, saying, 'Your son, whom I will set on your throne in your place, he shall build a house for my name.' Now therefore command that they cut down cedars for me from Lebanon, and my servants will be with your servants. And I will pay you wages for your servants according to whatever you say. For you know, there is none among us who has the skill to cut timber like the Sidonians." So it was, when Hiram heard that the words of Solomon, that he rejoiced greatly and said, "Blessed be the Lord this day, for he has given David a wise son over this great people." Then Hiram sent to Solomon, saying, "I have considered the message which you sent me, and I will do all you desire concerning the cedar and cypress logs. My servant shall bring them down from Lebanon to the sea. I will float them in rafts by sea to the place you indicate to me, and I will have them broken apart there. Then you can take them away, and you shall fulfill my desire by giving food for my household." Then Hiram gave Solomon cedar and cypress logs according to all his desire, and Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 cores of wheat as food for his household, 20 cores of pressed oil that Solomon gave to Hiram year by year. So the Lord gave Solomon wisdom, as he had promised him, and there was peace between Hiram and Solomon, and the two of them made a treaty together. Then King Solomon raised up a labor force out of all Israel. The labor force was 30,000 men, and he sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 a month in shifts. They were 1 month in Lebanon, 2 months at home. Adoniram was in charge of the labor force. Solomon had 70,000 who carried burdens, 80,000 who quarried stone in the mountains, besides 3,300 from the chiefs of Solomon's deputies who supervised the people who labored in the work. And the king commanded them to quarry large stones, costly stones, hewn stones to lay the foundation of the temple. So Solomon built builders, Hiram's builders, and the Gebelites quarried them, and they prepared timber and stones to build the temple. May God commit the reading of his word to our minds, hearts, and wills tonight for his glory, our eternal good, by his Spirit. Now, I was thinking on this, what we covered last week, and I was thinking of Acts 13:22. God says that David was a man after his own heart. And when we first think of that, we always think of what in the world is God saying there, because we know of the sins in David's life. 1 Samuel 21. David was a coward. You remember after Saul tried to kill him, he went to Gath and the king there, and he was afraid that he would be killed by the Philistines. So you remember what David did? He acted like a madman. And so he was able to escape that. We know in 2 Samuel 11, he was an adulterer. Adulterer with Bathsheba in the spring when Joab took the forces, they went to Ramoth Gilead to besiege the city. David stayed behind in the spring of the year, and normally kings went to war in the spring of the year, and he had all that spare time and he got into trouble. And then we know what happened in 2 Samuel 12:9, that he ended up to be a murderer. Uriah, the husband, had him at the front lines and had him killed on David's orders, basically. Put him on the front line. Those who were at the front line right below the wall of an enemy were the ones with the highest propensity to be killed. So, how do we respond to that when God says, a man after mine own heart? And I always go to John 7:53-8:11. Anybody know that? The woman in adultery was brought to Jesus, remember, by the leaders. And what did Jesus say? He who among you is without sin, cast the first stone. See, we all sin. What David did, we know from Psalm 32 and Psalm 51, is that David repented of his sin. David repented of his sin. And he repented of his sin, and when you repent sin, God forsakes that. He blots it out. And he puts it behind us, never to bring it up again. And David was one who was truly desirous of doing God's will. What God wanted to be done, that was David's heart. And so, yes, he is a man after God's own heart. And we see that, here in when he compiled the materials for the temple. Remember, we read last week 1 Chronicles 22. And the word that was keep repeating in there was abundance. Everything David compiled was in abundance. The gold, the silver, the timbers, and the iron for the nails, and etc. Everything was in abundance. And then, what David did was, 1 Chronicles 28 and 29, we read those. 1 Chronicles 28 and 29 is that David gave the plans. Now, he not only the materials, but also the plans. And then remember, he gave of his own treasury gold and silver. He gave sacrificially of his own treasury of the gold and the silver. And that prompted his officers then to give willingly the same way. And the people then followed the example of David and the officers. And they all gave very willingly then to God's work. And let's turn in our Bible. We use this for call to worship. But I want to read 1 Chronicles 29, verse 9, and then David there has his thanksgiving in verses 10 through 15. 1 Chronicles 29, verse 9. Then the people rejoiced, for they had offered willingly, because with a loyal heart they had offered willingly to the Lord, and King David also rejoiced greatly. So you go up to verse 6, offered willingly, offered willingly. Does anybody recall anything in the Old Testament that might jog there that you see a similarity to that? Anybody? Moses, yes, yes. Turn in your Bible to Exodus. Keep your finger there on 1 Chronicles 29. Don't lose that because we're going to get back to that. But Exodus 35:20-36:7, I'm just going to highlight a few things there. We don't have to read the whole things. But just to jog your memory, Exodus 35, this is where, from verse 20 there, tabernacle offerings are presented. And verse 21, everyone came whose heart was stirred, lifted up. Everyone whose spirit was willing. Verse 22, they had a willing heart. Verse 29, free will offering to the Lord, all the men and the women whose hearts were willing. Verse 31, and he was filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom, there, Bezaleel, in that. And verse 2 of chapter 36, this great artisans, God had put wisdom in them, and the workers with him, everyone whose heart was stirred to come and do the work. And verse 5 of 36, the people bring much more than enough for the service of the work which the Lord commanded us to do. So we commented last time, remember, David compiled all of these materials in abundance. What did Solomon do? Solomon added to the materials in abundance. And the cross-reference for that is the willingness here, the free will offerings of the people. They got in line with David and Solomon there, and the free will offerings. And all of that spells people that are after God's own heart. Think of how God gives to us. Think of how God gives to us. He gives abundantly, he gives freely, he gives liberally, lovingly, devotedly, faithfully, etc. So let's look here at 1 Chronicles 29. We read verse 9. Let's read David's praise to God, verses 10 through 15. 1 Chronicles 29, 10 through 15. Therefore David blessed the Lord before all the assembly. And David said, blessed are you, Lord God of Israel, our Father, forever and ever. Yours, O Lord, is the greatness, the power and the glory, the victory and the majesty. For all that is in heaven and in earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O God, and you are exalted as head over all. Both riches and honor come from you. Think of Deuteronomy 8:18. Our wealth comes from God. And you reign over all. In your hand is power and might. In your hand it is to make great and to give strength to all. Now therefore, our God, we thank you and praise your glorious name. But who am I and who are my people that we should be able to offer so willingly as this? For all things come from you, and of your own we have given you. Just think. Let's read verse 15 here. For we are aliens and pilgrims before you, and were all our fathers, our days on earth are as a shadow and without hope. Verse 14 again. But who am I and who are my people that we should be able to offer so willingly as this? For all things come from you, and of your own we have given you. Think of Psalm 68:19. Blessed be the Lord who daily loads us with benefits, the God of our salvation, Selah. He daily loads us with benefits. James 1:17, every good and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom is no variableness nor shadow of turning. 1 Corinthians 4:7, who maketh thee to differ from another, and what have you that you did not receive? And if you receive it, why do you boast as if you didn't? Everything comes from God's good hand to us. I always remember an episode of The Simpsons on TV. It was about Thanksgiving time. And Homer comes home, you know, and he says, he comes home and it's Thanksgiving and they got the meal. Thank God, he says, I'm the one who went to work. I'm the one who got the put in the hours and got the paid for the wages. And I'm the one that bought the materials here and the food on the table. It's because of my work, my. That was Homer Simpson. And no, everything comes from God's good hand to us. So when we think of people after God's own heart, turn to 2 Corinthians 9, 6 through 8. 2 Corinthians 9, 6 through 8. And my contention is this is one of these verses. It's like with the Great Commission in Matthew 28, 18 through 20. We should never read 19 and 20 without 18. Because all authority, Jesus says, is given unto me in heaven and earth. Then he says, go. We go under Christ's authority and in his might. And the same thing when you look at 2 Corinthians 9, 6 through 8, I think that should never be read without verse 8. 2 Corinthians 9, 6 through 8. But this I say, he who sows sparingly will reap sparingly. He who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. So let each one give as he purposes in his heart, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that you always having all sufficiency in all things may have an abundance for every good work. And what I've done there in the past is I have written there as a cross-reference 1 Chronicles 29:12 that we read, both riches and honor come from you, you reign over all. Powers in your might, your hand it is to make great and give strength to all. I think we've got good examples there when it comes to men after God's own heart, of people after God's own heart, and how to give. And I've written here in my notes, may there never be a shortage in giving to the Lord's work at Grace Baptist. There will never, Deo Valenti, be any compulsory sermons on giving at Grace Baptist. And where, in other words, what do I mean? And Pastor Ryan and I have said this before. If we are preaching through expositorily, verse by verse, and a text on giving is in the context, then we'll preach on giving. But otherwise, we will not go out of our way to arm bend people to give to the Lord's work in that. No way, no how. If it's the Lord's work, it never lacks the Lord's supply. Philippians 4:19, God is able to make all grace abound toward you. God is able to supply all your needs in Christ Jesus. See, God's the giver, and he enables us to give a portion to his work. We use this for at giving 2 Corinthians 8:5. The Macedonians, think how poor they were. The context there is originally what happened, Paul used the Corinthians and their giving as an example to the Macedonians on how they should give freely to the Lord's work and liberally and abundantly in that. What happened is, over the year that lapsed, the Corinthians had waned in their giving. What happened was the Macedonians, who were a lot poorer than the Corinthians, they had given sacrificially and abundantly and all that. So what does Paul do? He turns around and then he flips it, and he uses the Macedonians then as an example to the Corinthians. Say, hey, what you've begun, let's pick it up again and complete then what you've begun. See, for this offering for the famished church in Jerusalem. See, and 2 Corinthians 8:5 says they first gave themselves to the Lord and then to us by the will of God. See, and my contention is, when we read texts like this, consider God, how God gives and how God supplies and how God blesses. We first give ourselves to the Lord, knowing the Bible truths and who God is and how he gives liberally to us. And then we give ourselves to his kingdom work here and give accordingly. We could say unequivocally in the end that David's greatest desire was to do God's will. God's will. And God blessed him too, because in his line the Messiah came. Okay. Now, one last thing before I leave this. Look at 1 Chronicles 22:5. 1 Chronicles 22:5. 1 Chronicles 22:5. Now David said, Solomon my son is young and inexperienced, and the house to be built for the Lord must be exceedingly magnificent, famous, and glorious throughout all countries. I will now make preparations for it. So David made abundant preparations before his death. Now, David wants to honor God. That's the way he approached it. So put that in the context of Grace Baptist, a small rural church in Wilmer, Minnesota. How do we look at Grace Baptist, the church building here, and what we call our meeting place? What does it say to God? What does it say to non-believers? I always remember my parents grew up in Depression. And I always remember both of them were very staunch on saying, you may be poor, but that doesn't mean that you can't be neat, that you can't have things looking in order and looking presentable and decent and everything like that. And I agree wholeheartedly. And I've always been very pleased at how Grace Baptist has turned out with the provisions that God has provided for us. The money's not how it's been spent. In other words, the facility here fits our needs, I think, just perfectly. And the size for the congregation, all of that. And we have to be careful that our sanctuary and all that, we want things looking clean. We want things looking in order. We don't want things looking run down and have torn things or ripped this or, you know, unpainted this. The landscaping, we want the landscaping to look nice. So when people go by, what does it say? See, to non-believers. And whatever we do, whether we eat or drink, we do what? 1 Corinthians 10:31, we do it unto God's glory. See, and we want a good reflection of God on unbelievers and everybody. People drive by on the highway, they look and they see the garden, they see the orchard here, and they see the cross, and, you know, they see the front of the church and all that. We had a wedding here. We had a lot of visitors from the Twin Cities and all of that, see. And so that's what we have to be. We don't have, you know, money sticking out of our ears where the gold and silver is like the stones in the street. But we do is, by God's grace, use what we have, the resources, wisely, and we use it to His glory. And we want things looking the best they possibly can to reflect Him and bring glory to Him. Okay, now let's look at what I've titled this tonight is, what are we building and for what? So what's our purpose and what we're doing, what we are building? Think of our own homes and our lifestyle and everything else. And we in America are so distorted on things, because if you take all the Americans on a worldwide basis, Americans are in the top 10 to 15% of the world's wealth. And this was true years ago. I remember when the Baptist church in town was the General Conference Baptist, and they had their magazine called The Standard. And in that was an article that said basically the same thing, and that was quite a few years ago. But those were, they had done a study on the members of the Baptist General Conference and the peoples that were attending the church in the top 10, 15% of the world's wealth. And in America, we lose sight of that. I mean, poor people in America, they've got air conditioners and they've got cell phones and they got this, that, and everything else, you see. And but to whom much is given, much is required. Luke 12:47-48. So how do we use the resources, you see, that God has given us? And that comes to play when you think of materials here. We're in the preliminaries, the gathering of the materials now for the building of the temple. I just put theme here, a couple verses here. Whatever we do, whether we eat or drink, we do all to the glory of God. So whether it's compiling gold or silver, or whether we're working with wood and stone, you see, whatever it is, we do it all to God's glory. Whether we've got a big pile, abundance, or whether we got a little, we're accountable before God. Think of the parable of the talents. See, accountable before God for what God has given us, how do we use what we have? And then, are we laying up for ourselves treasures on earth, or are we laying up for ourselves treasures in heaven? And that's why Piper's book, Don't Waste Your Life, I think is so crucial. You know, and I think of my boomer age. There's so many. I just went up to St. Cloud with the van this morning. And the van, there were engine lights on all over. And so I got the oil changed and all that. That light went away and all that. But then there was a hole in a tire. So I got the tire repair. So that was good to get that repaired. So now there's no engine lights on. I feel much better. But I was up there, and there's the guy that sold us the van. You know, I asked, well, his son works for the car dealership. So and they're always friendly to me, and I'm friendly to them, because they sold us the van and the truck that we use for snow removal. So the dad, he's up in age, and my age and all that. Well, what's your dad doing? I asked the son today. Well, he's traveling here. He just got back from Europe, and in the fall they're going back to, I forget what foreign country they're going, and he's traveling all over. Well, what's Piper saying? You know, as a believer, you retire and all that, what do? You go down to Florida and you're walking on the shore and you're compiling your seashell collection, and then you show that to God You know, God says, what have you done with the talents and the resources I've given you? And you show him your seashell collection. Yeah. So, yeah, the accountability is awesome here in America for how God has blessed us. Yeah. And Solomon, you see, we'll get into that too. He built his own house 11 years in the building, and the other he built the temple in 7 years and all that. And, you know, whereas David bothered him. It bothered David that David lived in a cedar house and God was essentially his meeting place was a tent. See, and that bothered David. Yeah, Zerubbabel's temple here, yeah. So, the preliminaries here, compiling the materials, we went through all of that. It authenticates God's promises. Remember, all of this is based on 2 Samuel 7:13 in the Davidic covenant, 2 Samuel 7:13, where David is told that his son, by God, that David's son will build the temple for God. See? And God's faithfulness to his promises. God promises it. And that settles it. Engraved as in eternal brass, the mighty promise shines. Nor can the powers of darkness raise those everlasting lines. See, God said it. That settles it. He will do whatever he promises to do. And this anticipates God's kingdom. See, God's kingdom here. Now, when we get to 13 through 18, conscripting men. Conscripting men. I wrote a definition here of conscription. Is a compulsory enrollment of persons, especially for military service. September 29th, I was reading on the internet there in Putin, the largest fall conscription he had in 9 years. He had 135,000 men they just drafted now, seeing called in. 135,000. And that's the largest conscription, the article said there, in 9 years. And I shared this before, but when I grew up in high school, it was during the Vietnam War era. And every young man got his draft number out of 365 days in a year. You got a number, see, of the day. And then they had a lottery where they drew the number. And then you went to Vietnam if your number got called. And I remember the day I was sitting by the radio, you know, sweating it like crazy. Here the number's called, see, and I'm sitting there waiting. Well, I had, by God's grace, I had 152, and I know at least they called in Wilmer 118, 119 got called. So I had classmates that ended up over there and all of that. So, but that's what we're calling about conscription. See, conscription. So let's get into it here. And what I'm going to do at the end, hopefully I got some time, but I want to get into, and this is kind of preparatory for chapter 6, but I want to get into quarrying stones. And it's just fascinating to me. You know, sometimes we can think, you know, oh, we're in the 21st century and we're so brilliant, you know, and they were just a bunch of dummies back then. They didn't know anything and all that. And, you know, it's just amazing how, what they did back then and the skill involved and everything else. Okay. Verse 13. Okay. Then King Solomon raised up a labor force out of all Israel. And the labor force was 30,000 men. Now, this labor force is all Israelites. This 30,000 here, this 30,000 is all Israelites. And I just erased everything that I had written there about the labor force. So I hope you got it all. See, now that's, I'm at that age. Just remember, I'm at that age. 30,000, all Israel. And this is a temporary, now this is important, this is a temporary workforce. Temporary workforce. Turn in your Bible to Leviticus. Let's see, I got to get the verse here. Yeah, Leviticus 25:39. I had that written where I erased it, naturally. 25:39. Very important verse. Leviticus 25:39. And if one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you, you shall not compel him to serve as a slave. Okay? Now, turn in your Bible to 1 Kings 9, 20 to 22. 1 Kings 9, 20 to 22. All the people were left of the Amorite, Hittites, Perizzite, Hivites, Jebusites, who were not of the children of Israel. That is their descendants who were left in the land after them, whom the children of Israel had not been able to destroy completely. From these Solomon raised forced labor, as it is to this day. But of the children of Israel, Solomon made no forced laborers, because they were men of war and his servants, his officers, his captains, commanders of his chariots and his cavalry. Okay? Now, there's a difference here. This is mas in the Hebrew, and this is amas obed in the Hebrew. So this is a forced labor, but this is a slave labor. And the slave labor, was of non-Israelites, aliens in the land of Israel. And this was a permanent. Once you're in this labor force, you didn't get out of this labor force, whereas with the Israelites, it was temporary. It was temporary. And so you had, let's see here, 1 Kings 9, let's get back here to 1 Kings 5, verse 11. By the way, I did want to note one thing too. Look at verses, I'll pick up on verse 14, but look back at verses 9 through 12 and notice what was going on. Well, let's read those verses. My servants shall bring them down from Lebanon to the sea. I will float them in rafts by sea to the place you indicate to me, and will have them broken apart, and you shall take them away. You shall fulfill my desire by giving. Okay? I've highlighted that. Giving food for my household. Verse 10. Then Hiram gave. I highlighted that. Solomon cedar and cypress logs according to all his desire. And Solomon gave Hiram 20,000 cores of wheat, food for his household, 20 cores of pressed oil that Solomon gave to Solomon year by year. So the Lord gave. See all the giving in there. There's 5 different times, 5 being the number of grace. But in those verses there, the giving that's going on. And it's mutual giving between Hiram and Solomon. But you see, it's the Lord that's over all of this. And what is the ultimate gift? The ultimate gift is the wisdom that the Lord gave Solomon. So all of this is God's wisdom, including the labor force. Okay? So in verse 12, you see the Lord gave Solomon wisdom. Then, verse 13, Solomon raised up the labor force. See? Now, what's the kicker here? What we could have questions raised in our mind. Because what happened was, remember, in verse 5 of chapter 4, 6 of chapter 4, Adoniram, the son of Abda, was over the labor force. Okay? He's over the labor force. Now, you go to 12:18. This is after Solomon now. You've got Rehoboam, the son. Then King Rehoboam sent Adoram, that's short of Adoniram, the same guy in 4:6 called Adoniram. Here the short form is Adoram, who was in charge of the revenue, but all Israel stoned him with stones and he died. So we say, well, this labor force was temporary of Israelites. The forced labor was of the slaves, the aliens. And yet here you've got Israelites at the end of Solomon's reign. They want their work lightened. And they want that this done away with. See? So What happened? Well, I was puzzling on that. Go back to 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8. Remember when they asked for a king? Let's look at verse 11 and following. And he said, this will be behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and be his horsemen. Some will run before his chariots. He'll appoint captains over his thousands, captains over his fifties. Will set some to plow his ground, reap his harvest, some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. He will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, your olive groves, give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and vintage, give it to his officers' servants. He will take your male servants, female servants, your finest young men, and your donkeys, and put them to do his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. Choices have consequences, right? So it's a cumulative effect. This having your loved ones gone for 4 months out of the year is part of it. But having your sons and your daughters and everybody else, the kingdom, you see, from David, he had a small labor force, like we said in 1 Chronicles 22:2, a small labor. But Solomon's kingdom is much, much bigger. The bigger the government, the more the demands on the people, see, to run everything. And that's what happened. And eventually they'd had their fill. Yes. And with Solomon and that too, with all of this, where does it end? Because it seems like it's just more and more and more. So the government is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and your freedoms are getting what? Less and less and less. Less government, more freedom. That's what we're talking about here, right? Yeah. So it all comes to play. It all comes to pay. They take. And finally you say enough is enough, see, and you're ready to rebel. Now, verse 14, he sent them to Lebanon 10,000 a month in shifts. They were 1 month in Lebanon, 2 months at home. Adonai was in charge of the labor force. So that's why, you see, now total that all up, 4 months out of the year, your husband, you see, could be gone. 4 months out of the year. Now, verse 15, he had 70,000 who carried burdens, 80,000 who quarried stone in the mountains. Now, these kind of tasks, there's totals here, 150,000. We've got the 70, and I had this all written so nice over here, and it's all gone. Yeah, and that's interesting too, because like we said in Chronicles 22, he made the cypress logs and that as the sycamores that were in the lowland. Just like he made the gold and silver as the stones in the street. Okay, so you got this superabundance coming in, and then you've got to have skilled workers take care of all of this stuff. And then, you see, besides the 12 districts where he's supplying the food for all of his court every year, remember, each district had to do it 1 month out of the year, all of this food was what? Year by year kept flowing from Israel to Hiram. So that created demands on the people too. See, besides, all of this to me just keeps ratcheting up. You could say the same with America with its debt and everything else. I mean, let's say I have that quote from Herbert Stein on my wall. What can't go on forever won't. I mean, he was a famous economist. That's what he said. Sometimes, it's going to crumble like a bunch of cards. Time for choosing. Famous. Yeah, and I think he even had a quote, I don't know it exactly, but he likened it to an alimentary canal that on the one end has no restraint. So you see what's happened here is this right in the context, our immediate context, this is God's wisdom, the temporary labor force. This is God's wisdom. What? It's all for the temple, to build the temple. See, focus on that. But remember, Solomon had all sorts of building projects. The temple was one of them. But he's building his palace and he's got all his other things. You can imagine. 1 Kings 11, what he's going to do? He's building a temple, what? For every one of his wives. Every one of their idolatrous gods, they get their own worship center. So, I mean, it's, yeah. And so the people eventually, you see, I mean, it's. And God, you know that God turned against Solomon, because what happened here, when we get to the end of this, Solomon remembers 1 Kings 3 through 11. When you get near the end, all of these enemies are rising up against Solomon. And that's all under God's bounty permission, see. Yeah, judgment is coming. And the only reason it wasn't judged during Solomon's reign is because of David. So it's just sad, really is. Now, verses, we got here through 16, besides 3,300 from the chiefs of Solomon's deputies who supervised the people who labored in the work. So he had these 3,300, then there's another 500 people above that, and then there's another 250 Israelites above that. So they had all of this tiered organization. And some of those figures are taken from Chronicles. But all the tiered organization, see, just like when he sets up those districts, you got to have all of this bureaucracy to keep everything functioning. Yeah. It's just unbelievable. Now, verse 17. And the king commanded them to quarry large stones. Large stones, costly stones, hewn stones, to lay the foundation of the temple. So Solomon's builders, Hiram's builders, and the Gebalites. Now the Gebalites were Phoenicians. They lived south of Tyre, along the coast. They quarried them, and they prepared timber and stones to build the temple. They were skilled, very skilled in... it says in, Ezekiel 27:9, they were stonemasons and shipbuilders. So that's part of the skilled labor that Solomon tapped into, you see, for his labor force. Now, what I want to do here now, and this is like kind of preparatory to chapter 6 too, but these quarrying these stones, to me, it's just fascinating. I've got a book here, Secrets of Jerusalem Temple Mount, that I've had on my shelf for years. But it's fascinating where they get into these quarrying of these stones. What's the stone that is most prevalent throughout all of Israel that they ended up using for the foundation stones and the walls and all that at the temple? What kind of stone are we talking about? Limestone. Okay? Limestone. And what's fascinating on limestone is in layers, horizontal layers. And so you can have some that are just a few inches thick, but you could have some that are 5 feet thick or even more. Now what they do is when they're going to quarry these stones, and these are master builders that do this, is that they'll take a stone, and let's say you've got an exposed stone. Okay? Let's just say here we've got a stone here. This size, whatever it is here. Okay. But what they'll do is this exposed is the skilled labor, what they do is they'll chisel this smooth. And they'll chisel this smooth, okay? So you've got that much chiseled smooth. Then what they do is they will take big chisels and they'll go in between here and they'll chisel down 4 to 6 inches. And they'll chisel just, you know, right down in this limestone. Then what they do on two sides is they take timbers and they put the timbers and they'll line the timbers up like this, down in that groove. And it's on two sides. So it actually would be this side and this side. If this was exposed, it wouldn't be that one. Okay? There. So they'd line up the timbers down in this where they've chiseled it out, like that. And then what they do is they soak the timbers. soak the timbers. The timbers swell, and then what happens? This cracks along that line, this cracks along this line, and then this line on the bottom, wherever that depth this is, if it's 5 feet deep, this cracks along this side, down on the bottom, and it's smooth. Smooth. So then you've got three sides that are smooth right away. It's a layered rock. Sedimentary rock, a layered rock. And so you'll see that you'll see they'll have a limestone, like a, let's say there's a lime, and you'll see all of these areas, you know, where they've kind of, you know, taken and chiseled areas out, and they've been working here, see, on this area. And so you see all of this stuff, see, where they've done this. And these stones, it's amazing. Let's see, where was this here? Just the size here of these stones. The stones, and you see this same technique was used in Zerubbabel's. This would be used in Herod, the time of Jesus. Same type of thing. But like the stone in Herod's western wall, 16 feet by 13 feet. The foundation stones, they could be 12 feet to 15 feet across. And some of these stones could... Yeah. Yeah, that'd be like 12 feet, right. And these could be like 15, 16 feet even long, see. Some of these stones were big enough to weigh up to 80 tons. 80 tons. Now, first thing you do is you ask yourself, okay, how does this stone get on top of the next stone, the next stone, the next stone? Now think of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, where in Acts chapter 8, Simon Stylites, what's his name? No, Simon Magus, excuse me. I'm thinking of an early church father, the guy that ended up on a pole. That's, just forget it. Okay. Simon Magus in Acts chapter 8. Tradition has it that he died by jumping off the temple above the Kidron Valley, 468 feet. To his death. Well, how do you get all of these big stones up there? There are some guys that said, do you know how they got up there? By angels. Angels carried them. But that isn't what happened. Okay, what happened was, and this is interesting, is that the quarry things, where they quarried the stones outside Jerusalem and that, the quarry stones were hundreds of feet above the level where you put the foundation stone. Okay? Above the foundation stone. So what they do is they take a big stone, one of these big things here, and they had a crane. And what it was they just wood and that, but they had a system here where you had ropes and whatnot. And it'd get a hold of these stones, and you'd have oxen. When they got to Herod's temple, they used over 1,000 oxen. Or 1,000 oxen. When Nancy and I were at Williamsburg, they had some oxen that were traipsing around the courtyard. And there was just some 20-year-old kid leading these big animals around. And they were huge. I mean, they're just mammoth. Remember that? Just huge. And so they had over 1,000 ox. So they had it winched up, and these stones, what they did was they'd leave, and they've got, even to this day, they've got some stones on the wall where they had projections. What they did was they'd leave a projection on two sides. And this projection would be like 12 to 18 inches, something like that. So what you do is you put a rope around each one of those, and you'd raise up one end of the stone, and then what you do is you put a log underneath, see? And then you lower it down, you put another log, you put the oxen in front, and then you pull this thing, And what you do is you keep putting logs in front, and then you take those in the back and you move them to the front, and you'd have the big oxen herd, you know, the team of oxen here, 10 oxen. Some of them were 8, 10, 12 oxen front, depending on the size of the stone. And then you'd keep doing that. You'd have guys that would take these rollers. Now, you remember when I started my garden business on County Road number 9, I went and bought a shed, pre-made shed. And what I did was I set up my watering system inside of that shed. And I wanted that shed back in my growing beds. Well, how was I going to get it back there? And what we did was my dad came over and we used rollers. Do you remember that? Yeah. And we used rollers, the same type of a system. Worked slick. Just took them over my plants. It didn't destroy the plants because the logs were perfectly round, you know, and they just rolled the building over the top then and got it to where I wanted it and set her down. See? Just worked slick. Worked slick. And so that's how they'd move those things. Now, this was, like I said, where they quarried was hundreds of feet above where the first foundation stone was. So you were going downhill, and this wasn't as steep, you know, but it's over a period of distance, see. So it isn't that steep. But that's what he did. And then what they did was they filled from the inside. So if this stone was this, then you'd take dirt on the inside and you'd fill it up to this level. Then you brought the next stone and then you'd fill it up to that level. And then the next stone, you'd fill it up. So they filled it all from the inside. So they didn't have to raise any stone at all. They just took the stone right on the level of the ground and got it over there on top of the one and deposited it there, and that was it. See? Slick. And these stones were big enough, so just think of the force of all of this dirt piled up, all of that hundreds of feet of dirt piled up, think of the force that would put on a wall. But you've got stones here that weigh up to 80 tons. They ain't moving. Now, what happened was the smaller ones that were broken off, back at the quarry, if you had smaller ones, let's say you had 2-ton, 3-ton stones in that, those are the ones that used for buildings on the inside of the temple, the smaller ones. And in 70 AD, when they had 66 to 70 AD, when you had Jerusalem besieged and the Romans were trying to get into Jerusalem, the Temple Mount and that, what they did was they took the 2 to 3 ton stones from the buildings, tore them apart, and dropped them on the Romans. Try to prevent them from scaling the wall. So they ended up strewn all over. Matthew 24:2, Jesus said that there will not be left one stone upon another. Remember? And you say, how could that be? And Jesus said it. It was fulfilled exactly as Jesus said. You know what happened? They set fire to the Temple Mount and Jerusalem. And the gold melted. And the gold melted between the stones, and the Romans wanted the gold. So what did they do? They pulled these stones apart to get at the melted gold. And so the prophecy was literally fulfilled. Not one stone was left upon another when they got done. See? But that solved the thing. Angels didn't have to pile it up. They just kept piling dirt on the inside and then just put that stone right on top, filled the dirt up to that level, then put the next stone up, filled dirt more, and just kept going. Slick. Just so slick. Yeah. Artisans. See, artisans and wisdom. Wisdom. Artisans and wisdom. The temple had, the Temple Mount, there were 16-foot thick walls. 16-foot thick walls. And you're talking, you know, hundreds of feet above the foundation stone. So, yeah. Yeah. And sometime if you ever get up in North Dakota, go to the Teddy Roosevelt, what is it called? National Park. Teddy Roosevelt National Park. And you go in there, and they have, you know, regular mountains there, whatever you want to call it. But out of these mountains are perfectly cylindrical balls. Just come right out of the mountain. So just dotted, and then on the big, just huge. And then on the bottom, near the bottom, it's like a bunch of these big marbles laying at the bottom too. You know, you're scratching. Perfect. Yeah. Yeah. We could drum up a picture or two of those. Yeah. Yeah. It's perfectly round, coming right out of the mountain. It's just crazy. Okay, so we come back to this just in conclusion. What are we building and for what? See? God's going to hold us responsible for what He has given us. See? Don't point the finger and say, well, that man has this much or they have that much. You know, they should be doing this, that, that, that. No, God's going to say, what did you do with what I gave you? If you have one talent and the next guy has two or five or ten, what did you do with the one? And you know what's interesting too is like Acts 5:29, it's more blessed to give than to receive.